This episode is brought to you by Accounting Plus. We've heard about career killers, but how about a killer career? Accounting has got it all. You'll have flexibility, great pay, and the kind of lifestyle you've always dreamed of. If that's not enough, you'll have the opportunity to make a difference by using your detective skills to investigate financial mysteries. Want in? Accounting Plus provides free resources that'll help guide you to a successful career in accounting and personal freedom. Do more. Live more. Visit joinaccountingplus.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
Trick or treat!
Halloween night, 1979. The San Fernando Valley is swarming with children out on the prowl for some candy. But what their parents have yet to discover is that this year, there's something far scarier than a ghost or goblin lurking in their midst. 16-year-old Shirley Lynette Ledford was hitchhiking home from a Halloween party when two men pulled up in their van and offered her a ride. Shirley recognized one of the men as 39-year-old Lawrence Bittaker, one of the regulars at the restaurant where she waited tables part-time. On one occasion, Bittaker had even asked Shirley out on a date. And while Shirley had declined that offer, Bittaker still seemed nice enough. So she accepted the ride. Upon entering the van, the second man, 31-year-old Roy Norris, held Shirley down while he bound and gagged her with construction tape. The two men then proceeded to humiliate, torture, and rape Shirley Ledford. While sodomizing the 16-year-old, they stabbed her with vice grip pliers, hit ice picks into her ears, and beat her elbows with a sledgehammer. They told her not to stop screaming. For them, seeing that look of terror on the face of a young girl was all part of the thrill.
After 2 hours of brutal torture, Roy Norris wrapped a wire coat hanger around Shirley's neck, twisted and tightened it with the pliers, and slowly strangled her to death. Shirley Ledford was the final murder victim of Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris, who terrorized the streets of Southern California during their 5-month killing spree in 1979, taking the lives of at least 5 teenage girls. Just before she died with her eyes open, Shirley Ledford's final words were, "Do it. Just kill me."
Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker had recorded their entire encounter with Shirley Ledford on a cassette tape, now considered in the world of criminology to be some of the most disturbing audio ever recorded. The tape horrified members of the jury and those in the courtroom when it was played at Lawrence Bittaker's trial in January 1981.
Here is a direct quote from one of the courtroom spectators, a woman who had to leave while the recording played. Quote, "I've heard screams before. I didn't. I thought I'd be able to sit and listen, but I've never heard anything like that in my life," end quote.
A male spectator had this to say, quote, "I just couldn't believe it. I have a daughter and I just could see her and I just, I just couldn't take it," end quote. A third spectator, a man who was obviously very disturbed by what he had heard, was quoted as saying the following when interviewed by news outlets, quote, "I never felt so close to fainting in all my life. I've prosecuted people. I prosecuted for murder, rapes, but I just can't believe it," end quote.
Of the recording, Roy Norris himself had this to say.
"We've all heard women scream in horror films. Still, we know that no one's really screaming. Why? Simply because an actress can't produce some sounds that convince us that something vile and heinous is happening. If you ever heard that tape, there's just no possible way that you'd not begin crying and trembling. I doubt you could listen to more than a full 60 seconds of it."
When prosecutor Stephen Kay presented the tapes in court, he gave the jury the following warning, quote, "For those of you who do not know what hell is like, you will find out," end quote. And that they did. Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and this is Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of serial killers. This week, our subjects are Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris, dubbed by the media as the Toolbox Killers, due to their use of common household tools as instruments of sadistic torture. If you want to listen to any episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all on your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation. Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker first became acquainted with one another in 1977 while serving time at the California Men's Colony, a prison in San Luis Obispo. Norris had been convicted of raping a woman in Redondo Beach in 1975, while Bittaker's offense was the attempted murder of a supermarket clerk in 1974. Though both men had extensive criminal histories prior to meeting in 1977, it wasn't until they began reinforcing each other's dark, twisted fantasies during their time in prison that their crimes escalated to murder. This begs the question, is prison really helpful for criminals? What happens when we isolate criminal personalities from the rest of civilized society and lock them in close quarters with other criminal personalities? To answer this question, let's bring in Vanessa. Vanessa will be answering questions I have about the mental makeup of a serial killer. What makes them tick, what molded them, and what their thought process is like, as well as providing other valuable insight. It's important to note that she's not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but like me, she's fascinated by the psychology of serial killers and has done a lot of research for the show. Welcome, Vanessa.
Good to be here, Greg.
So, Vanessa, when Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker were sentenced to prison for their respective offenses, I'm assuming the goal for them was to reform before being released, not for them to use that time to plan a sadistic killing spree.
That's probably a good assumption, Greg. We often think of prison as a place where criminals are incarcerated and deprived of their freedoms in order to protect the rest of us from further harm, right? However, one of the stated goals of many U.S. prisons is the rehabilitation of prisoners. Unfortunately, the research shows that time spent in prison hardly ever successfully rehabilitates most inmates. One of the fundamental concepts in criminal justice is what's known as recidivism, which is the tendency for people who have already been sanctioned for a previous crime to relapse into criminal behavior. According to the National Institute of Justice, approximately 67.8% of criminals in the United States were arrested again within 3 years of being released from prison. After 5 years, that number rises to 76.6%.
So three quarters of criminals are repeat offenders? Why is that?
Good question. One aspect to consider is the makeup of a criminal personality. So psychologists use what's known as the Big Five model to measure the dimensions of an individual's personality and psyche in order to determine their personality type. These five traits are openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism.
And which of those traits are more closely linked with a criminal personality type?
Well, while criminals' personalities vary in most of these traits, we find that the criminal personality consistently scores low in the trait agreeableness, meaning they tend to place their self-interest above the well-being or interests of others, and they're not likely to compromise or extend themselves for the sake of social harmony. So unless the proper psychiatric resources are made available to prisoners to spend their sentence trying to change this aspect of their personality, crime will likely remain a part of their identity. That's why there's a debate going on in our country about reforming our prison system to shift the emphasis from punishment to rehabilitation, such as is the case in many European countries, where rates of crime and repeat offenders is significantly lower.
Yes, I see. But is it typical for the crimes committed by prisoners to escalate so drastically after being incarcerated, as was the case for Norris and Bittaker?
Unfortunately, it isn't uncommon for that to be the case. Just think about it. If prisoners aren't spending their time trying to rehabilitate, they're going to be socializing with their fellow convicts, for whom crime is also a way of life. Many criminals actually learn new and better ways to commit their crimes in the future when they're incarcerated. And of course, as with Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris, prisoners can also make connections and fall deeper into the criminal world than they were before being locked up. In this case, we're looking at a clear-cut example of a phenomenon known as folie à deux.
Folie à deux. Well, let's go into that a little more for all our listeners who need to brush up on their French.
Well, literally, it means something like double insanity. But that translation is more fitting for its original meaning, to refer to the psychological phenomenon of two closely associated people who shared the same psychotic delusion. But nowadays, we use the term to refer to the pernicious bond formed between two individuals who bring out the worst in each other, egging each other on to commit criminal acts that neither one would have the courage to commit on their own. Psychologist Horace B. English suggests that a more accurate translation of folie à deux, as it's used today, might be a gruesome twosome.
So what do you think it was about Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker that made them the perfect gruesome twosome?
Well, in most cases of folie à deux, we tend to see a dominant personality who takes the lead in plotting and planning the crime, and a more subordinate individual who acts as the former's willing and eager accomplice. In this case, Lawrence Bittaker was our dominant personality, while Roy Norris acted as his accomplice. But I think to fully answer your question, perhaps we ought to look back at their formative years and early criminal activity to get a better understanding of their respective pathologies.
Our story will continue in a moment, right after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Accounting Plus. We've heard about career killers, but how about a killer career? Accounting has got it all. You'll have flexibility, great pay, and the kind of lifestyle you've always dreamed of. If that's not enough, you'll have the opportunity to make a difference by using your detective skills to investigate financial mysteries. Want in? Accounting Plus provides free resources that'll help guide you to a successful career in accounting and personal freedom. Do more. Live more. Visit joinaccountingplus.com.
With Capella University's FlexPath format, you can set your own deadlines, learn at your pace, and access most coursework from anywhere at any time. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
And now, back to the story.
Let's start with Lawrence Bittaker. Born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on September 27, 1940, Lawrence's birth mother placed him in an orphanage as a newborn infant, and he was eventually adopted by the Bittaker family.
Abandoned at birth, huh? Off to a rough start.
Oh, we're just getting started. Bittaker began his life of crime at just 12 years old, obtaining a minor criminal record for petty theft and shoplifting. When asked about his earliest criminal activity, Bittaker had this to say.
The first time I can remember, I stole a mustard seed and a glass ball on a chain. It was a present for a female acquaintance. It was just a girl I was with.
A mustard seed and a glass ball on a chain. Sounds like an odd gift, doesn't it?
Well, perhaps it wasn't really about trying to impress this girl with a gift. I mean, sure, consciously, that may have been his motivation, but let's not forget that Bittaker also stated that these early theft-related offenses in his youth may have been cries for attention and attempts to compensate for a lack of love from his parents, which is more than likely the underlying unconscious motivation for these early crimes. He must have been pretty smart to have picked up on that part of his unconsciousness.
pretty smart might be a bit of an understatement in this case. Get this. Lawrence Bittaker was known to have an IQ of 138.
Wow, and 140 is considered a genius level IQ. That means he was in the top 1 percentile when it comes to intelligence.
So what do you think that means in terms of being a serial killer?
Well, the average IQ for all Americans is 98, right? While the average IQ for serial killers is 94.7, which seems surprisingly average. However, we do know that a number of serial killers did have abnormally high IQs. Ted Bundy had a 136 IQ, Jeffrey Dahmer had a 145, Kristen Gilbert, 152.
Wow.
Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, had an IQ of 167. So while IQ can't tell us a whole lot about one's likelihood of becoming a serial killer, according to Radford University's 2013 study, IQ is heavily correlated with a serial killer's method of killing.
How so?
Well, when it comes to death by bombing, a highly technical skill, the average IQ of a serial killer is 140.3. But in the case of Norris and Bittaker, whose preferred method of killing was strangulation and bludgeoning, a very manual, hands-on process, the average IQ is 108.8. These are the two methods that will likely be used by killers with above-average intelligence. In cases involving shooting, stabbing, or bludgeoning alone, we tend to find killers with below-average intelligence. Serial killers with higher IQs are also more likely to kill for enjoyment, whereas killers with lower IQs tend to kill for personal needs, such as money or power.
So it almost seems like these serial killers with higher IQs get some kind of extra gratification in the craft of the kill, so to speak.
Well, that would certainly be true of Lawrence Bittaker.
It's a shame. With a mind like that, he probably could have gone on to do a lot of good if he applied himself elsewhere. Instead, Lawrence Bittaker dropped out of high school to pursue a life of crime. His adoptive father's work in aircraft factories forced the family to move around quite a bit. They eventually settled in California, where a 17-year-old Lawrence Bittaker was imprisoned in the California Youth Authority for auto theft, hit and run, and evading arrest. After his release, when he turned 18, Bittaker discovered that his adoptive parents had disowned him and relocated to another state. He never saw them again.
Perhaps that was part of what caused Bittaker's considerable concealed hostility, in the words of the psychiatrist who evaluated him, while he was incarcerated for a robbery he committed in 1961. That same psychiatrist also described Bittaker as being a highly manipulative character.
Which we know is a common trait among psychopaths.
True, Greg. However, no psychological or psychiatric organization, such as the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, has officially sanctioned a diagnosis for psychopathy. What we typically consider to be the traits of a psychopath fall under the diagnostic criteria for antisocial personality disorder in the DSM.
So that must have been what was going on with Bittaker, right?
Well, not officially. After he was once again imprisoned for parole violation in 1964, Bittaker underwent another psych evaluation and was diagnosed as a borderline psychotic, resistant to acknowledging responsibility for his actions, and highly manipulative behavior is a defining characteristic of borderline personality disorder, which causes abnormal behavior classified by an unstable sense of self, unstable relationships with others, and unstable emotional states.
But you said he was a borderline psychotic. Doesn't that second part mean he was a psychopath?
That's a pretty common misunderstanding. As some of our earliest listeners may remember, psychotics and psychopaths are not the same thing. Psychopathy is classified by a definitive absence of empathy, while psychosis is a broad condition of the mind involving a disconnect from reality. According to the MacArthur Violence Risk Assessment Study, only a small number of psychotics actually commit acts of violence. And while borderline personality disorder only affects roughly 1.6% of the population, 20 to 50% of those affected report experiencing features of psychosis, such as hallucinations and delusional thinking. This was likely how Bittaker came off when he described to the psychiatrist that his criminal activities gave him a feeling of self-importance.
Well, maybe we should listen to what Bittaker describes as the motivation for his actions in his own words.
I'm going to tell you the truth. My psychosexual development stopped when I first got incarcerated at 16. I spent 40 of my 65 years in jail, destroyed my social and sexual development. I never had a normal upbringing. My family life was like I was a boarder. I don't hate women. I just can't understand raping an 80-year-old woman. You're raping someone who's unattractive. Something is screwy with that. But I can understand the rape of an attractive girl who turns you on. I love girls, young and attractive. My fantasy is a girl screaming, but because of pleasure. My whole life I had no woman who loved me, and that's what I wanted so bad. That's why I took the girls into the mountains.
While Lawrence Bittaker may have been a dedicated lifelong criminal, it wasn't until a confrontation in a supermarket parking lot in 1974 that he displayed a proclivity to kill. Lawrence Bittaker was browsing the aisles of a supermarket when a young clerk named Gary Louis observed him attempting to steal a steak. Louis followed Bittaker out to the parking lot to politely ask him just one question.
Excuse me, sir, have you forgotten to pay for anything?
Bittaker's response? He immediately stabbed Louis one time in the chest, just narrowly missing his heart.
When Lawrence Bittaker was tried in 1981 for the murders he and Norris committed, his defense presented testimony from psychiatrist Dr. Tronkman, who argued that this assault may have been induced by an altered state of consciousness.
And what would have caused this altered state of consciousness? Drugs? Psychosis?
His defense argued that Bittaker had been suffering from amnesia after allegedly consuming alcohol with tranquilizing medication. They also called upon Dr. Michael Maloney, who testified on Bittaker's behalf that this episode seemed out of character for Lawrence Bittaker. While he may have had a lengthy criminal history, none of Bittaker's early offenses had ever turned violent prior to this. However, witnesses from the supermarket testified that there was no odor of alcohol on Bittaker, and that he didn't appear unsteady or incoherent in his speech.
Well, whether under the influence or not, he nearly killed Gary Louis. So Lawrence Bittaker was convicted of attempted murder and sent off to the California men's colony, where he would eventually meet his partner in crime. Now, on to Roy. Roy Norris was born in Greeley, Colorado, on February 5th, 1948. Like Bittaker, Norris was mostly estranged from his birth parents, with a childhood rooted in isolation, in and out of foster care. Norris claims to have been neglected by many of the foster families he lived with, often denied sufficient food and clothing. He also claimed to have been the victim of sexual abuse as a child while living with a Hispanic family, which he stated became the source of his racism toward Hispanic people. During a brief period, when Norris was living with his birth parents, he made a sexual pass at a female relative in her 20s. When Norris's father was informed of the incident, he threatened to beat his 16-year-old son. So, Norris stole his father's car and drove off to the Rocky Mountains, where he attempted to commit suicide by injecting pure air into an artery in his arm. Norris was swiftly apprehended as a runaway and returned to his parents' home. It was then that his parents informed him that he was an unwanted child and that they had only married to avoid the stigma of an out-of-wedlock birth, and now they intended to divorce. Norris joined the United States Navy and was stationed in San Diego between 1965 and 1969. At 21, he was deployed to serve in Vietnam. Although he did not see active combat during the 4 months of his deployment, Norris experimented with heroin and marijuana while in Vietnam and would become a regular user of marijuana from that point. From 1969 to February 1970, Norris sexually assaulted one woman and attempted to rape at least two others before he was arrested. Less than 3 months later, military psychologists diagnosed Norris as having a severe schizoid personality, and he was discharged from the Navy on the grounds of psychological problems.
According to the DSM-5, schizoid personality disorder, also referred to as SPD, is characterized by a lack of interest in social relationships, a preference toward solidarity, secretiveness, and difficulty in expressing emotions. Even when directly provoked, a person with a schizoid personality may have difficulty expressing any kind of hostility or aggression in social situations.
Vanessa, while Roy Norris may have had quite a few problems, I wouldn't exactly say that a lack of hostility or aggression was one of them.
Not in general, no. You're right, but you're missing the key phrase, being in social situations.
Oh.
While it's perfectly normal to feel anger or hostility towards certain people in certain circumstances, most of us are typically able to express that to the person our hostility is directed at without resulting to violence. But not Roy Norris. He would suppress those feelings and let them bubble up inside until he would eventually release all that pent-up rage on one of his innocent victims in a violent attack. But in social settings, those with SBD tend to come off as emotionally cold, apathetic, absent-minded, and self-absorbed.
But why is that?
Well, because they tend to preoccupy themselves with the elaborate internal fantasy world they've developed in their minds. For Roy Norris, this fantasy involved committing heinous acts of sexual violence towards young women. And while living in their preferred fantasy world may make it difficult for those with schizoid personality disorder to form any kind of intimate relationship with another person, Roy Norris did make a connection with someone who was willing to participate in his sadistic fantasy.
I think I know where you're going with this. But before we get there, can you explain the difference between schizoid personality and schizophrenia? They sound awfully similar.
Of course, I can see how that can be confusing. Well, when it comes to personality disorders, there are three categorical clusters. Cluster A consists of disorders classified by odd or eccentric behavior. Cluster B covers dramatic, emotional, or erratic disorders. And cluster C is made up of anxiety-based personality disorders. Schizoid personality disorder is a cluster A disorder, along with schizotypal personality disorder and paranoid personality disorder. While these are three distinct personality disorders, cluster A disorders are all linked by a genetic risk of developing schizophrenia and share some of its hallmark symptoms, namely odd social behavior and an inability to distinguish fantasy from reality. Thus, SPD is considered a schizophrenia spectrum disorder.
I see. How common is SPD exactly?
SPD affects between 3.1 and 4.9% of the population and is more prevalent among men than women. But for the record, the probability that a person with only a schizoid personality will be implicated in serial murder is almost non-existent, especially when compared to certain cluster B disorders such as narcissistic personality disorder or
borderline personality disorder?
Exactly.
Well, before we get back to Lawrence Bittaker, let's finish up with Roy Norris. In May 1970, while on bail for his latest offense, Norris brutally attacked a female student who he had been stalking on the campus of San Diego State University. He bashed her in the back of the head with a rock until she slumped onto the ground, at which point he repeatedly slammed her head against the pavement, fracturing her skull and nearly killing her. For this, Norris was convicted of attempted murder and sentenced to 5 years at Atascadero State Hospital, classified as a mentally disordered sex offender. Norris was released in 1975 after being declared by doctors as someone who posed, quote, no further danger to others, unquote. But this couldn't have been further from the truth. Just 3 months after his release, Norris approached a woman walking home from a restaurant in Redondo Beach. He grabbed the woman's scarf, twisting it around her neck as he dragged her into some nearby bushes, and raped her. For this crime, Norris was convicted and sent to the California Men's Colony, where he would dream up the most vicious crimes he had yet to commit.
We'll return to our story in just a moment from the Parcast Network.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And now, back to our story.
Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker became acquainted with one another about a year after Norris' arrival at the California Men's Colony in 1977. On at least two occasions, Norris claimed Bittaker saved him from being attacked by fellow inmates. Gradually, they became closer and closer, as Norris taught Bittaker how to construct jewelry. And it wasn't long before they discovered a common interest.
Any fours?
Go fish. But you know what really gets me off when I'm with a girl?
What's that?
I like to hear her scream. That's what really gets me going.
With pleasure? Or fear?
Either one works.
See, for me, it's the fear that really turns me on. Looking at a young girl's face, shrieking with terror. The look in her eye when she realizes there's nothing she can do. To me, there's nothing sexier in the world.
Really?
Really. It's what keeps getting me thrown back in the cage. It's like I can't get off with a girl the same way unless I force her against her will. That's the only way I know that she's really scared. You ever force a girl?
Nope, never. But if I ever did, I wouldn't get caught for it.
How do you know?
Because after I finished, I would kill her. Got a six?
Go fish.
Norris and Bittaker continued to bond over their mutual interest in misogyny and sexual violence. Together, they cooked up plans to rape and torture teenage girls once they were released. They even concocted an elaborate fantasy in which they would rape and then kill one girl of every teenage year from 13 to 19. Unfortunately, they were dedicated to turning their fantasy into reality.
Misogyny and sexual violence towards women aren't exactly atypical motivations for serial killers. When Lawrence Bittaker was asked about his feelings towards women, he had this to say.
I like women. I don't think they're beneath us. I got wrapped up in a screwball fantasy. It wasn't exciting. Well, it was exciting in a certain sense. Age is not relevant as long as they're young and attractive. I got a problem with women anywhere near my adopted mother's age. My adoptive parents were kind of old when they adopted me. In their 40s. Having sex with a woman of that age reminds me of my mother, a sex object.
Bittaker's mention of his adoptive mother and her age shouldn't be disregarded when it comes to our attempts to uncover the underlying motivations for his sick crimes. After their arrest in 1979, Southern California's leading forensic psychiatrist, Ronald Markman, evaluated Norris and Bittaker to determine the extent to which they could be held accountable based on their mental condition. Regarding their motivations, Markman had this to say, quote, their underlying motivation probably is an attempt to deal with a humiliation. It may have been by the mother. It may have been by a girlfriend or a potential girlfriend. Those are humiliations that can lead to this kind of behavior, end quote. It's likely that for Lawrence Bittaker, he was dealing with a humiliation by an older woman, possibly his adoptive mother, and he sought revenge against women by dominating and humiliating younger, weaker girls who he could easily overpower.
Bittaker was released from the California Men's Colony on October 15, 1978. His near-genius IQ helped him find work as a skilled machinist in Los Angeles, earning close to a six-figure salary. But it wasn't money Bittaker was after.
No, it wasn't. Despite his salary, Lawrence Bittaker rented a modest little room at the Scott Motel in Burbank, which tells me he had no intention of establishing a permanent place of residency, but wanted the ability to pick up and move somewhere else at the drop of a hat if need be.
Maybe the self-identified loner, Lawrence Bittaker, wasn't looking for much of a community, but his regular donations to the Salvation Army helped him acquire quite the reputation in the neighborhood for being a generous and helpful individual. But it was among the local teens with whom Bittaker was most popular. His Burbank motel room became a hotspot where teenagers could go and hang out. Bittaker always offered them marijuana and kept a fridge stocked with beer. Think he was trying to reclaim those teenage years he lost in prison?
Perhaps, but I'm inclined to think this behavior goes back to Bittaker's attraction to teenage girls. In the words of prosecutor Stephen Kay, quote, they were afraid of older women, end quote, but Bittaker was comfortable around teenagers. It put him in a position of dominance. As psychologist Michael Maloney points out, Bittaker was attracted to younger people, girls that had started to come of age. They're less threatening. They're going to be docile, they're not going to challenge him, end quote. But luckily, aside from getting them stoned, Bittaker wasn't known to have done anything malicious to any of these teens during this time on his own.
Maybe not on his own. But when Roy Norris was released 3 months later, the two men reunited and were eager to put their sadistic plans into action. They purchased a 1977 GMC cargo van, a spacious, windowless vehicle with a large sliding side door. Bittaker named it the Murder Mac. From February to June 1979, the duo picked up at least 20 female hitchhikers along the Pacific Coast Highway. These were, quote, practice runs, unquote, used to develop techniques to lure girls into their van voluntarily. In April, they discovered a secluded fire road in the San Gabriel Mountains. Bittaker exited the van, broke the locked gate to this fire road with a crowbar, and replaced the lock with one of his own. At this point, I'd like to warn our listeners that what you are about to hear contains some disturbing and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. On June 24th, 1979, Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker got their first taste of what they've been fantasizing about for the past 2 years. Earlier in the day, the men had finished installing a bed in the rear of their van. Underneath this bed, they kept a set of tools. At approximately 7:46 p.m., Norris spotted a, quote, cute little blonde, unquote. 16-year-old Lucinda Lynn Schaefer, known to friends and family just as Cindy, was walking home from a church meeting in Redondo Beach when Norris and Bittaker drove up beside her in their van and offered her a ride home.
Thank you, but I enjoy the walk.
They tried to entice her by offering some marijuana, but Cindy knew better than to take candy from a stranger. Cindy did what any parent would hope their child would do in that situation and declined their multiple offers. So, Norris and Bittaker drove up ahead and parked in front of a driveway. Norris got out of the van and opened the sliding doors. When Cindy passed by, Norris dragged her inside the van and shut the door. As Norris bound up her arms and legs with duct tape, Bittaker blasted the music on the radio full volume to drown out Cindy's screams, a ruse they would use regularly in future murders. Cindy regained her composure as Norris and Bittaker drove her to the secret fire road in the San Gabriel Mountains. When they arrived, Norris and Bittaker took turns raping her while sending the other man, quote, on a walk. After Norris raped her for the second time, Cindy Schaefer asked him if they intended to kill her. Norris replied, no. Cindy told Norris that if it was their intention to kill her, she wished for, quote, only a second to pray before they did so. After several hours, Norris attempted to manually strangle Cindy Schaefer to death. But about 45 seconds in, something came over him when he saw, quote, a look in her eye. And he ran to the front of the van and started to vomit. Norris picked his false teeth out of the throw-up, while Bittaker strangled Cindy until she fell to the ground and began convulsing. He then twisted a wire coat hanger around her neck with vice grip pliers until her convulsions ceased. And Cindy Schaefer was dead. Her body was wrapped in a shower curtain and thrown off a steep ledge of a canyon. Bittaker told Norris that the animals would devour her remains, leaving no trace of evidence. Cindy Schaefer was never given a moment to pray. Cindy Schaefer was only the first victim of Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker, the toolbox killers, who would go on to rape, torture, and kill at least four more girls on three more occasions. 18-year-old Andrea Hall on the second occasion, 13-year-old Jacqueline Leah Lamp, and 15-year-old Jackie Doris Gilliam on the third, and 16-year-old Shirley Lynette Ledford, their final victim before their hellish rampage was put to an end.
So how did a pair of killers this organized get caught exactly? Why did the brutality of their torture escalate with each successive victim? And whatever happened to that torture tape we mentioned at the beginning?
Well, we'll be answering those questions and many more on next week's episode of Serial Killers.
Thank you for listening to Serial Killers. Be sure to join us next Monday as we conclude our look into the twisted minds of Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker. If you enjoyed this episode, please tell your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory, or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's Parcast Network.
Have a killer week.
Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Donnie Gofstein and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Manu Narayan and Steve Pinto.